This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. For a small agency, New Hampshire Fish and Game seems to attract large attention. Headlines from the practice of bear baiting to the struggling moose population to the return of the bobcat all seem to get Granite Staters talking and often disagreeing on what they think the right course of action should be. And at the center of these debates is our guest today, Glenn Normando, Executive Director of Fish and Game. A former commercial fisherman and environmental engineer, Normando was tapped in 2008 to lead the agency and was appointed to a second term in 2012. For Normando and his team, these ongoing arguments about wildlife management are welcome and expected in an outdoors-oriented state like New Hampshire. And they're especially appropriate this year as the agency is in the midst of updating its 10-year Wildlife Action Plan and celebrating its 150th birthday. Today in The Exchange, Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando is with us, and let's hear from you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Director Normando, it's nice to see you. Welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, before we get into all the different headlines that I mentioned, I did want to ask you a couple broad questions. 5 or 10 years ago, there was talk of how fewer Granite Staters are hunting and fishing, and just in general, not even getting outside. What do the numbers look like in terms of people engaging in those outdoor activities, not just hunting and fishing, but hiking and so forth?
Well, I don't know about hiking per se, although perception is that, certainly on good days, it's packed up there in the White Mountains. If you go look at the parking areas driving up over Pinkham Notch or whatever. Fishing, I think, has been fairly steady, freshwater fishing. It's had its ups and downs, but it's fairly steady. There has been a decrease in hunting, especially through the 90s. Not coincidentally, about the time that cell phones and all sort of came out, you saw a sort of a steady decrease in numbers between 1990 and 2000, and it's been sort of level since then. And I just think that in the electronic age, we've had a shift where new kids coming in are not fully replacing older folks that are bowing out of hunting, and therefore there's been a change in where that steady state level is.
New Hampshire's also become a more suburban state than a purely rural state.
That is true. And, certainly since, say, 1980, I don't know whether we've probably increased by at least half, if not more, in population. I get commentary all the time from people about I don't have any place to hunt anymore. And when you bore down into that, what it really means with a lot of these folks is not that there's no place to hunt. It's that the place that they hunted all their lives is not available anymore because now it's a housing development. Now it's schools, it's businesses, it's in the southern half of the state, it's become tough. And there's still plenty of places to hunt in the state, but a lot of folks' favorite places they grew up with aren't there anymore.
They can't just go out their backyard and,
exactly.
and do it anymore. You know, there's a lot, Director Normando, that your agency does that is not at all related to hunting and fishing, even though the name, Fish and Game, it's conservation, it's land management, it's public education. How much is Fish and Game these days becoming more the great outdoors agency, whether or not somebody wants to hunt or fish?
I think that we are, you know, certainly spread out in a large way that in that respect. I mean, if you look at just the OHRV side, snowmobiles and off-road vehicles, that's a huge part of our operation. We're responsible for enforcement, education on that. Certainly, the non-game side is big. We currently operate 142 boat access sites, which are not just utilized by people launching boats to go fishing, but by a large number of recreational canoers, kayakers, wildlife watching in general is a huge part of outdoor recreation in this state. And in fact, its economic value is on par with hunting and fishing combined.
So ATVs, if somebody is, behaving recklessly in an ATV, they go on someone's land even though they want them there, or there's an accident, that's you. You're in charge of that. So ATVs, snowmobiles, wildlife viewing, boat access, and yet the name Fish and Game sounds pretty traditional, hunting, fishing. Is it time for a new name?
I'll let that question get decided by the commission. That has always been a hot potato, and certainly the traditionalists would like to see it remain the same.
Why is it a hot potato?
I think people...
Given the breadth of what you do.
Because I think that the core funding sources for the department still revolve around hunting and fishing activity, and I think those people that are paying that freight have a traditional attachment to the name as it stands.
So the agency is largely funded by hunting and fishing licenses, and that's been a sore spot, hasn't it?
It is. It's tough. It's tough on us, and I should say not simply the licenses, but also the federal excise taxes that are paid by people buying hunting and fishing equipment. And although they're paid at the wholesale level, so you don't see them when you buy a fishing rod or a gun at the store, about 10% plus or minus of every purchase of a piece of fishing or hunting equipment is going into a federal trust fund that's distributed to the state. So a significant amount of our funding, well over 50%, is strictly coming out of hunters and fishermen.
Okay, so here's the question, and you and I have talked about this before. How do you tap into that whole vast population of people who are benefiting from the work that you folks do but not paying in?
Well, that's a good question, and it is one that that every state has fought with over, around the country. And as usual, it's really a lot more of a political question than it is a needs issue. I mean, in most states, the fish and wildlife agencies are, in need of funding. And the way that's been done is different in every state. We're the only, I believe, the only department in New England that does not get a regular general fund appropriation. So that's the way some states have dealt with it. States that have a lot of energy resources, often there's some either taxes or direct payments associated from there. So, the Dakotas, Pennsylvania with shale gas, things like that. Some states that have broad-based taxes, there are dedicated pieces of those that go into their fish and game fund. In New Hampshire, it's been sort of piecemeal, and it certainly transcends agency needs and just becomes a political, sort of tug of war as
so
to how that's.
How could you guys tap into that those folks more, that market more? And say, hey, we're maintaining the boat launch, we're keeping the habitat restored, we're making this wildlife viewing possible so that you can, enjoy that. How do you tap into that?
Well, I think, two possible ways would be either a dedicated piece of rooms and meals tax, which would go directly to the sort of thing that the department funds. Or the road we're on, and of course we're a ways yet from seeing what comes out of the Senate in the first budget. In the next biennial budget, but the The legislature did give us approximately $1.5 million in the last budget, and
in general funds,
in general,
which was unusual,
which was very unusual, to keep us basically at the level we're at without further reductions. And in this budget coming up, we're working on a process of hopefully getting some sort of funding, whether general funds or others. And also out of the House, we were given the authority to set our own fees instead of being done legislatively, which would also be beneficial.
Yeah. I remember in years past, maybe this was even just last year, Dr. Normando, there was talk about, I think a couple years ago, a backpack tax or a hiking boot tax, or I mean, there are different ideas to just kind of get, again, that outdoors crowd chipping in a little bit for what you do.
Right.
And those didn't go anywhere?
No. You know, I mean, I'm a realist, you know, about what's possible politically, and so, you know, I mean, there's, you know, something like a state outdoor equipment sales tax.
I remember people talking about that.
I don't think there's much legs on that. So,
all right, here's another idea that also came up, and I think this was last year, and it caused a big to do. An email from Rob, and thanks, Rob, for emailing us. He says, "Isn't it time for a modest registration fee for canoes and kayaks?" Rob says, "Also, why can't we register our boats online? We can register our truck to pull it and even the trailer to haul it, but we have to make a separate trip to register the boat." Rob, thank you for the questions. Let's deal with that first one first, because this is an idea that was tossed about recently, a fee for those non-motorized boats.
Right. So that actually was put in the form of a bill, I believe, back in 2007, shortly before became director the year before, and was roundly torpedoed in the legislature. We have actually talked to some paddling groups, and the opposition to a fee where none has gone before is just extremely high politically, and you know, right, wrong, or indifferent. You know, that's the fundamental situation, and you also have to be realistic about the level of the fee. You know, people say, "Well, why couldn't it just be $5?" You know, well, the point is that it has to be at a level where our administrative costs are taken care of also.
All right. Well, coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about this, including whether, instead of looking around for more money, the agency should just do less. So we'll look at that. We'll also look at the struggles of the moose population and some controversy around bear hunting. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando is with us. We're talking about issues surrounding hunting, fishing, and the great outdoors in the Granite State and how we pay for it all. 1-800-892-6477. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. And Director Normando, just before the break, we were talking about Rob's email. He says, "Isn't it time for a modest registration fee for canoes and kayaks?" And you talked about some of the political pushback around that. Here's my question then. You guys do have a wide portfolio, as I talked earlier in the show, you know, search and rescue, habitat restoration, hunting, and so forth. Could you just do less? I mean, if the money's not there, maybe you just say, you know, it's nice, but it's not necessary, and just spin off or get rid of certain parts of your mission.
So I guess there's several answers to that. First of all, almost everything we do is statutorily mandated. So you could get the legislature to change the laws and send some of it to other agencies.
So by law, you have to do all those things that you do.
That's correct. Also, in this state, it's really a zero-sum game. There's no agency out there right now that's rolling in money. I mean, we live tight in New Hampshire. So if we gave up and said somebody else is going to do search and rescue, well, who is that going to be? And how are they going to get the money they need to do it? You know, I mean, and let's face it, tourism's our second biggest industry in this state, and someone's got to do it, because if you want some bad PR, just leave a few people up in the mountains to, you know, to fend for themselves, and we'll get plenty of bad PR on that. So.
Well, I do have to ask you about search and rescue, because these some of these have run up in the many thousands of dollars. Just remind us sort of how this works, Director Normando. You know, let's say I'm ill-prepared, I go up into the mountains, and all of a sudden I sprain my ankle.
Well, if you are prepared and something happens, and you know, then that's one issue. If you are not prepared and because of that you get yourself into trouble and we have to come get you, we are authorized to bill you. And so we do. And it's not just our say on that. Every billing is reviewed first by the Attorney General's office to make sure it fits that negligence criteria.
So some legal eyeballs have looked at whether you were negligent or not.
That's correct.
So give us an example. What does negligent mean? I mean, going up on in flip-flops and not bringing water?
Well,
I mean,
that would be negligent, yeah, for sure. And but it's you know, it is really a function of not being prepared is probably the simplest way to say it. There's a heightened term that is more about, you know, if you go there knowingly that you're not up to it. But but negligent is really just about not paying attention to the circumstances, not being prepared, you know, going up with inadequate clothing, nothing to eat, no water, inadequate, you know, shoes, you know, whatever, and then getting into trouble. And most people these days, you know, use their cell phone and expect us to go pick them off the hill. And it can be very expensive. You know, some of these little searches will be over $50,000 in cost.
And in wintertime, at considerable danger to our
folks, and also if it's a helicopter situation, the National Guard. Folks that are flying those planes.
Yeah, it's tricky, though, because as you said, you don't want to establish a reputation of a state where, you know, you just let people languish on the mountaintop. And there was the guy recently, right, that the 50 older gentleman in his late 50s who had just had, I think, an artificial hip, and he was doing this pretty extensive hike, and he was, you know, leaping from one rock to the other. And, of course, something happened, and you guys had to rescue him, and you said, here's the bill, and he said, no way.
Exactly. And we had, in fact, COs up on the Lafayette and that that were in at night. It was 70 blowing to 100 with pouring rain.
Wow.
It was finally get to the guy. They get him down the hill. He is irascible and unthankful. Anyway, so he got a bill. And in fact, I think it was last week, We finally won payment of it, or won the case in the Supreme Court. But I think the bill was somewhere over $6,000. I couldn't tell you how much it actually cost to go through all that for the AG's office, for us. And this is typical. We only get a portion of the money that we bill people for. It's a loser financially with what it costs us to go after these people. You'd be amazed how many folks who are making a bad judgment about going into the mountains have also made a bad judgments other places in their lives and don't have a dime to give you, even if they wanted to. So
all right.
It's a problem.
Well, if you want to call in with questions about search and rescue or some of the other items on Fish and Game's list, join us, 1-800-892-6477. We've been talking about funding the department and all it does, looking at some different funding ideas that have been floated about over the years. We're going to turn now to some specific hunting practices that have made news. And you can join us on those too, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. 1-800-892-6477.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's another email that came in. This is from Anne. She says, has a decision been made about hunting bobcats? I think this is a terrible idea. I have lived in the White Mountains for 35 years. I am out in the woods frequently, and I've never seen a bobcat. We are certainly not overrun with bobcats. Why would you even consider allowing them to be hunted? As far as I know, they pose no problem to anyone. Now, she has another question, too, that I do want to ask you. But this was a headline, gosh, about 6 months ago, I think, that the bobcat population is rebounding. That's the good news. And that some folks are thinking about hunting them again. Where does this stand, Director Normandy?
So if you look at part of our mission, it's not only to take care of natural resources and their habitats, but to make them available for public use and appreciation. So we had undertaken an extensive study, bobcat hunting, which, by the way, is allowed in Maine, Massachusetts, Vermont, New York, Quebec, and New Brunswick.
Really?
Bobcats are allowed to be hunted in all of those states. We wanted to know where our population was. The season had been closed quite some years ago. And so we undertook an extensive study over the past few years. And so the results of that were probably the most comprehensive study done by any state, showing that, in fact, the population had rebounded. The population could support a limited hunt. And, in fact, the trend in all the states, even the ones that have long had seasons, has been increased bobcat numbers. And so that was laid in front of the commission. The commission is the policy-making body of the department.
The Fish and Game Commission.
The Fish and Game Commission, which is there's a member from every county. They're governor's appointees. And so that's where the process stands right now.
I mean, so it's not been decided yet.
It's not been decided, and whether it will be any time in the near future, I couldn't tell you. I mean, it's up to them. You know, the department can answer the scientific question. The social question and the policy question is a different thing.
I see. So you guys are basically crunching the numbers, looking at the trends. The commission is the political body which sets the policy decisions,
right,
like the bobcat hunt
and
that Anne is talking
about.
So
what the department has done is said to the commission, if you wanted to do a season, this would probably be the framework that would work and could be supported. But to date, the commission's had no vote or even public hearing. And in fact, should that ever go forward, there will be the commission would vote to go to public hearing. We would have a series of public hearings on the issue. It would go back to the commission for a final vote. And then those rules associated with that would go to the JL Carr at the legislature for final approval. So this is not, as is the case with all rulemaking in New Hampshire, this is not where a state agency or one person snaps a finger and says, this is the way we're going.
Well, and this relates to the second part of Anne's email. So thank you, Anne. She says, is the public comment period over? I called Fish and Game to make a comment and was told to comment online, but I don't see where on your website to comment. And you guys are in the midst of this 10-year wildlife management planning process, so it is a time for people to chime in.
So, right. That's something different. The reason there's no comment area for bobcats is because there's no proposal on the table at the
Got
moment.
It.
If at some point the commission puts it out there, then we would immediately be setting those sorts of dates. The big game plan, that's something different. That's where every 10 years – we try to set the levels of what people want mostly for the big game species, although we do small game fur bearers also. So that process that we're working our way through right now is one where we're not talking about hunting methods. We're not talking about specifics. What we're talking about is in this region, we'd like to see X amount of bears, X amount of deer. We know that if we have more than that, we're going to have problems. Less than that, some people may not be satisfied. And then every 2 years when we do our seasons and method of take, things are changed based on the data to reach those objectives.
All right. Here's another email that came in. And by the way, the email address is exchange@nhpr.org. You can call, too, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is an email from Laura, and there's 2 points here, actually, I want to share with you, Director Normando. One is this idea of a wildlife management plan. She says, my comment for the pending 10-year wildlife plan is, let them manage themselves as nature intended. Man's meddling, she says, has manifested itself in Lyme disease, killing true predators that would manage other species as nature intended. Then there's another point that she makes, but what about that? Why do we even have to, quote unquote, manage nature, wildlife?
Well, first of all, most of those predators that did it all, we don't live, much as people might want to think we do, we don't live in a virgin environmental system. We live in a place where people are managing everything, whether they know it or not. And so we have issues with deer overpopulation. Not bad ones yet, but in certain parts of the state, it's a problem. We have, every spring and into summer, major bear issues. And there's nothing's out there that's a natural predator of bears. So the idea that we can let it all go back to nature, I mean, hey, you could, but I'm going to tell you it's going to be a mess.
Well, you mentioned the bears, and that's the second half of Laura's email. She says, the arbitrary decision to slaughter up to 1,000 more bears in this state is sinful. She says, everybody I've asked has hardly seen bears, never mind them cluttering the streets and backyards or eating people's companion animals. Laura says, when people do see them, it's a rarity. It's exciting. They love seeing mothers with cubs. When I mention that your organization plans to slaughter up to 1,000, they shudder. I hope they take time to comment. This has been a headline that's come out recently, and I wonder what you think.
So that number, which is the real number, is more like about 600, is a function of one of the things that's coming out of the commentary on the overall state management plan, which was saying that based on what people have commented on as goals of where bears ought to be statewide, they would like to see in some areas fewer bears because of the conflict problems. And so we're looking at statewide bringing the population down by 500 or 600 animals.
In other words, issuing more hunting permits.
Well, actually, there's no license. There's no limit on hunting permits now. It would probably be, we'd have to look at, you know, maybe longer seasons or changing things around.
I see.
But this is over a 10-year period. It somehow, this number of 1,000 came out. I don't know where that came from. And it was also made to sound like we're going to run out in the woods in 1 year and kill 1,000 bears, you know, and this is totally wrong. And people have to realize, too, that, you know, we're not, you know, we're talking animals that have lifespans of 3 to 6, 7 years, 8 years. We're looking at a management situation where in some areas we have really big problems with bears. And unless you've lived it, you've got no idea.
Problems such as, I mean, beyond sort of swinging at the bird feeder.
Swinging at the bird feeder, dumpsters, campgrounds, personal contact has not been that big of a deal, but my counterpart in New Jersey, where they wouldn't let him legislatively hunt bears because of animal rights issues for a number of years, they're just got huge problems because of the overgrowth of the bear population. They had an individual killed by a bear last year down in New Jersey.
By a black bear?
It was a predatory kill.
Really? I'm surprised. Mm-hmm. I thought grizzlies were the only things you need to worry about.
No, I mean, you get them on a bad day, and, you know, that's not – by no means am I saying they're going to be out stealing your kids tomorrow. You know, I'm just saying that, again, it's part of this overall management as opposed to letting it all go wild.
All right. Well, I have another question for you about the Bears in particular, but let's go to our listeners as well. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Jerry's in Dover. Hi, Jerry. You're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Commissioner Normandal, I have a question concerning the management of some of the trout streams. I realize it costs a lot of money for Fish and Game to put trout in various streams. With the lack of funds, would Fish and Game be receptive to the idea of allowing private organizations to stock certain streams with changes of the rules, for example, to allow them to be fly fishing only or catch and release? Would that be something that Fish and Game might entertain?
Okay, interesting point, and given the limited resources.
I'd have to say it's probably a stream by stream. You know, what are we talking about? You know, I mean, a lot of people enjoy catch and release. The question is, you know, what's the particular, especially temperature profile of the streams involved, so that many of our places will put trout in the spring, people enjoy catching them, but by end of June, they're actually too warm to support wild trout. And the other issue is really one of, you know, where would the fish come from and whatnot. We are very cognizant of fish disease issues, as most states are, transporting fish around. So it's one of those devil in the details. We actually have a couple of limited areas where, in fact, some of the private TU organizations do put some fish in for late fall fishing. It's a matter of having a discussion with our inland fish chief and talking about the specifics of what we're dealing with.
Okay, Jerry, thank you for the phone call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Coming up, we'll talk a little bit more about bear hunting, specifically a controversy over bear baiting, and also look at the health of the moose population. More with Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normandeau in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, we're talking with New Hampshire Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normandeau, talking about some of the policies surrounding hunting and fishing and the great outdoors in the Granite State. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to call us. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Director Normandeau, just before the break, we were talking about an email from Laura. And Laura, thank you again for the email. She talked about the bear population, and you addressed this issue of, you know, what's the right number, so to speak. I do have to ask you about the policy of bear baiting. This was a big issue a couple months ago, whether the use of chocolate should be allowed in bear baiting. That was a big discussion. Some people even took issue with the practice of baiting at all. They said, where's the sport in that? You know, you bait the animal to come in. We heard from a lot of those folks. Where does this stand now, Director Normandeau, this whole bear baiting issue with chocolate?
Actually, the next commission meeting, which is, I think, Wednesday, the commission will take a vote on the chocolate issue, and we'll see where that moves forward to. Chocolate contains a chemical called theobromine, which has long been known to be detrimental to certain animals, and bears is one of them. And we had an incident that brought this to the fore in this past hunting season where several bears were killed eating chocolate. And we feel it's our responsibility as an agency to do something about that, obviously.
And again, you guys at Fish and Game are sort of doing the research, doing the analysis, but the commission, those political appointees from every county, they're the ones that are making the decision.
Well, they are the policy setters. That's right. I mean, you know, I should, you know, certainly they listen to the staff and the director.
To what your biologists
means,
and
exactly.
So forth say.
But, you know, as far as the larger issue of baiting in general, baiting for bears is a practice in I believe, 13 states, including Maine. For us, it's a management tool. I really can't get into the do you think you should do it or not, the ethics of it. You know, it's a legal practice, and it is the view of it's in the eyes of the beholder, I guess. The fact is we use it or allow it to good effect at keeping sort of some control over the bear population.
Well, here's an email that came in from Tom in Candia. He says, I'm out in the woods quite a lot and only too happy that bears are shy of humans in New Hampshire. By all means, favor hunting to encourage them to stay shy. Tom says, not a fan of baiting, though, partly for the danger of poisoning to non-bagged animals, but partly aesthetic to ambush hunting of this sort just seems wrong to me. It sounds like, thank you, Tom, for that email. It sounds like Director Normandeau, you don't want to get into the ethics around this baiting practice that seems unsportsmanlike to some people.
I get that. It's not my call, you know.
So, but the chocolate issue, your lead biologist on this has said, we don't think chocolate should be used.
That's correct.
At all?
That would...
Because it's toxic.
The proposal, I believe, would be to cut anything with chocolate in it. I'm not sure if the commission will modify that, but we will see.
All right. To ban all chocolate products, that's the proposal that you guys are looking at.
That's the proposal on the table at the moment. The commission, you know, we've had public hearing. The commission will consider that public hearing as will the staff, as we put together a final proposal to the commission. And that will become public. And then whatever gets voted on, we'll head over to J.L. Carr.
J.L. Carr, again, is?
The Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules.
Okay.
Which has to bless the state rule, the agency rulemaking process to give them the effect of law.
So it goes through several political iterations, it sounds like.
That's correct.
Well, Tom, thank you for the email. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Joe's calling from Campton. Hi, Joe, go ahead. You're on the Exchange.
Hi, yes. I have a question about what is apparently not an actual statute, but a tradition that's supported by case law for centuries that hunting is permitted on private property. The default is it's permitted unless there's a signage posted that says no trespassing, no hunting. And from my understanding of the website, reading the website, that it stemmed from the colonial period when hunting was necessary for survival for a lot of people. And then it has remained part of the New Hampshire tradition since then. And a lot of people who moved to New Hampshire from some other state aren't aware of that, because most states the default is you can't hunt on private property unless you get permission first, whereas that's not true in New Hampshire. And I'm just wondering, does that really make sense given the fact that the conditions are a lot different than they were back in the colonial period? There's much higher population density and there's a lot of safety issues with hunters going on to non-posted property to hunt when people aren't aware that they're not, you know, that there's no restriction against doing that. I know the courtesy is you're supposed to ask permission, but in fact there's no legal requirement that you do so. And so,
okay,
can you address that issue?
Yeah, and sure. It's a good topic, and we talked about it a little bit earlier too, just sort of this changing ethic, more suburban development, and so forth.
So I think, you know, it's probably true to some point about historical need to feed, if you will. However, I think if you look at who came to New England from England, that is embedded a lot more in looking back at, you know, the days when the crown and the royalty owned all wildlife, and it was a capital offense for a peasant to kill a deer or a stag in England. And the fact of the matter is that we hold wildlife in New Hampshire in the public trust for everybody. And so the feeling is that while you have a right to kick somebody off your land or to post your property, the fact is the private landowner doesn't own the wildlife. The public does. And the public has the reasonable legal use of that wildlife in all its forms. And, So I think that the roots of the system we have, not just in New Hampshire, it's kind of the way it is in Maine and Vermont, goes back to that colonial era resistance against the crown and the idea that the crown owned all the wildlife and the public was the unwashed masses were excluded.
That's actually really interesting.
Now, and I will also say, you know, we could go on this topic forever, but on the safety side, while a lot of people do get worked up about it, about safety.
In the fall, they hear the guns going off, they get nervous.
I have to say that I've been director over 7 years. I think, I could be wrong, but I think in my tenure we've only had one fatality. If you look at, 130 to 180 people a year getting killed on the highway, and people seem to think that that's just the price of doing business in car accidents or all the other stuff that goes on, and yet for some reason, not for some reason, I mean, I'm not saying they aren't catastrophic events, but, it's extremely rare.
That fatality was a hunter, is that right? I mean, I've heard that hunting accidents are among hunters.
I can't remember the last time in New Hampshire that someone was shot, a non-hunter was shot by a hunter. But in that, the case I'm thinking of, there was a person photographing his brother and father hunting or something, and somebody else unfortunately shot him.
Let's take another call, and thank you for that one. Let's go to Amherst. Ken's on the line. Hi, Ken. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Ellen. How are you today?
Good.
Ellen, I have a couple of comments. The first one is in regards to a gentleman commented on the ethics of bear baiting.
Right. Our emailer, Tom. Go ahead.
So I just want to educate Tom just a little bit that, first of all, our Fish and Game Department does a great job of managing our wildlife, and as far as baiting is concerned, it's really just another method of hunting. Whether you choose to hunt with a bow or a muzzleloader or a rifle, they're all methods of hunting. And as long as that method isn't detrimental to the population of the species we're hunting, I think it's really that person's choice to choose which method they would like. In the case of baiting, bears are primarily nocturnal animals, so... And I'm a bear baiter, I'm a bear hunter. And so you end up, placing bait, feeding these animals, basically, helping them get nourishment for the winter hibernation that's coming along, and in hopes that one will come in during daylight hours when at that point you can decide if you want to harvest that animal. And the reason I say if you want to decide is that by hunting over bait, you have the opportunity to observe these animals close, and you can tell if it's a female or a female with cubs or just cubs. So, an ethical hunter does not want to shoot a female or a female with cubs or cubs.
So you're saying, Ken, in one sense, bear baiting is maybe more ethical because you are making sure you're not randomly shooting a female or cubs.
That's correct. That's my opinion, along with many other, hunters that I know of. I'm a hunting guide also, so I've been doing this for a while. I have a lot of conversation with other hunting guides, and we really promote the taking of male bears, adult male bears. And so baiting, allows you oftentimes maybe to see an animal that you might not harvest, but you can really enjoy the experience by watching animals up close.
Well, Ken, here's my quick question for you. We talked about this on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup a couple months back, and we got so many emails, Facebook comments, calls. People said, baiting just isn't sport. The word hunting in and of itself implies that you got to go after the animal. And I just real quick wonder how you feel about that.
Well, I would say that the people that feel that way should try it, because they don't have to. You can bait an animal to take pictures, and so they should try it and see how difficult it really is.
Okay. Ken, thank you very much for calling in. We really appreciate
it. Another comment?
Actually, I got to let you go, Ken, because we've got a couple other people on the line and just 3 minutes left with Director Normando. But thanks for being with us. And let's go to Sharon in Pittsburgh, New Hampshire. Hi, Sharon. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, and I want to give a big kudos to Fish and Game up in Pittsburgh. They do an awesome job. Awesome. But my question was, are they going to cease moose hunting for a while up in Pittsburgh area since we have such a low population up there now?
You know, Sharon, this is a good question. And when I had to, Director Normando, we all hear about the struggles of the moose. I think there's about, a little more than 100 permits that you guys are giving out this year.
That's correct.
For moose hunting versus, you know, 600 or 700 not that long ago. Some people are saying, why even hunt the moose if they're struggling so much?
So a couple of things. Actually, the moose population up north is especially the Pittsburgh area, is right about at the goal we wanted it to be at. There's some other considerations up there related to why people don't see them like they used to. For example, purposefully have eliminated the salt beds around along Route 3 in what used to be called Moose Alley.
Sure, because I've been the up number there and I've seen moose.
The number of road kills was out of control. When I started in 2008, we were still under pressure to reduce the moose population, especially by foresters up in the Pittsburgh area.
Really?
Because of
over-browsing
some of the winter feed areas. you know, moose aren't disappearing tomorrow. We still have somewhere north of 4,000 animals in the state. We were at a peak in, I think, 96 at around 70-something hundred, and we were under pressure to reduce on all fronts. We were had about 100 more moose collisions a year back then than we do today. Certainly, they have the numbers are really in the central mountain area of the state is where we're most concerned about what's going on with the moose population. Now, if you have a business that partly depends on seeing moose, that's a problem, and we recognize that. You know, you don't have the huge clear cuts up in Pittsburgh that we did back in the 80s following the spruce budworms, where you could see 3 miles in any direction off the sides of the road. So it's a different scenario today. As far as the hunting side of it goes, the numbers that we're talking about are not affecting the population. You know, I mean, we talk about giving out 125 tags. The reality is it'll be about a 60 to 70% success ratio. We get a lot of our scientific data off of those animals. There's a lot of things we have. Every one of those animals gets checked. We do tick counts. We look at their physical condition, their weight, productivity. And that's how we are – a lot of how we're understanding what's happening in the herd is based on our examination of those animals that are taken by hunting. And I'd like to say that, you know, we've got 14 helicopters and it's like Marlon Perkins, you know, that we can go out and, you know, and needle all these things and check them out alive. And that's not the way life is. It's very, very expensive to do the collaring that we have ongoing right now.
That's the whole project that Fish and Game is doing with UNH,
UNH.
To check on the health of the moose
so
forth. Haven't other states, though, banned moose hunting? Minnesota, maybe?
Minnesota
given the struggles
has
of the moose?
Their population's gone to virtually zero in a very short time. And, you know, people, you need to realize we live at the southern edge of moose country, and whether or not warming climate's an issue, it certainly seems to help some of the parasites that are involved in the decline. And also some of the things that people like to see, like a lot of deer, are contributing because deer and moose don't get along that well.
Yeah, I actually read some
parasite issues.
Yeah, that deer carry a certain parasite.
Brainworm.
And it doesn't affect them, but it does affect the moose.
It's lethal to moose.
Yeah. So in central and southern New Hampshire, that's the problem. In northern New Hampshire, it's more the
ticks. Tends to be more the ticks. But, again, we're doing basic research to understand that there are other things going on in those animals besides those two issues.
All right. Well, lots of emails we didn't get to and phone calls. Thank you so much for being here, Glenn Normandeau. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Laura. Thank you.
That's Glenn Normandeau, Executive Director of New Hampshire's Fish and Game Department since 2008. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Faith Meixel and Jason Moon. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.